Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm going to begin with just a few moments of history. I'm very happy to be here, but I've been here before. More than 20 years ago, our minister at the Walpole Unitarian Church at the time, Sandra Whippy, asked us, the worship committee, if we would be interested in working with Susan Marotta, who was the chair of your worship committee. And it seems that your minister was having, I don't know if it was a reading break or a sabbatical, but he wasn't going to be here at all in the summer. And they were looking for ways to fill this pulpit that wouldn't break the bank. And we had a history of closing for most of the summer. So Susan and I met, and we involved West Brattleboro, and out of that came the River Valley Worship Exchange. And for three summers, we shared lay-led services with each other. We built a schedule. There was a service somewhere in those three churches every Sunday. And there were only, I think, two Sundays in all those summers where there was more than one dark church. So I think we did pretty well. And I enjoyed coming here, and I brought several different services. Not this one, this is new. And folks from here, folks from Brattleboro, moved around as well. So this is a bit of a historic reenactment, I guess. And when we began to work with Susan and her committee, we learned that there was a lay worship practice here that you called a credo service, not the teenage coming of age credo, but when the minister had a non-preaching Sunday, someone in your community would come forward and share their credo, their belief statement. We love that idea, and we still do it on occasion in Walpole. As a church without a creed, we are free to follow the Spirit wherever it leads us. This morning, I will share my own spiritual journey, a trip that has taken me to a much richer understanding of that which cannot be named, but which I experience when we are together in community. Now, hang on, I'm making sure I'm not losing my place here. Now we are going to have our chalice lighting, and Gwen is going to come forward and light the chalice, and we are all going to join in the chalice lighting words that are in the order of service. We light this chalice to celebrate Unitarian Universalism. We are the church of the open minds. We are the church of the helping hands. And we are the church of the loving hearts. And now is the time for our offering. Give what you will for the church that has meant so much to you, for the church that meant so much to those who came before you, and for the church that will mean so much to people you will never know. Give what you will, for you are a generous people. And know that no matter what you bring, the most important gift you bring is your presence in community this morning. Thank you. Meditation this morning, which will be followed by a moment of silence, is adapted from Elizabeth Tarbox. And so I say ours is a story of faith and hope and love. I say it is our need for one another that binds us together, that brings us laughing and limping into relationships and keeps us at it when we otherwise might despair at the fix we are in. I say it is the holy we need, the eternal beyond our comprehension, and one place we can find it is here, working and worshiping together. And I say there is a transcendent value worthy of our loyalty upon which we may set our hearts, and its divine manifestation is love. I'll be home again. The yearning for the most fundamental, intimate form of community. The place where when you have to go there, they have to let you in. Our first reading by John Gibb Millspaugh. Leave aside the little thoughts that distract you, for this place, like all places, is a holy place, and now, like all times, is a holy time. Join with the community of seekers, and together let us find. When I first read that, I thought, it's pretty facile. All places are holy, all times are holy. I didn't think that was true. I thought about it. And what makes a time and place holy is that a community has joined together in that time and place. Otherwise, time and place are simply spatial constructs. They're dry abstractions. But this time, this place is holy because of the community joined in it. My second reading, very short, it's from Matthew, and it's from the Jerusalem Bible in a section labeled Prayer in Common. In other words, shared prayer, prayer in community. For where two or three meet in my name, I shall be there with them. Whose name? Who's you? We can fight over the name forever, and we'll be doing that later. But what's important is the meeting of two or three with a common, common mission of building community. 2019 was a year of change and challenge for me. I learned the true meaning of the cliche, a blessing in disguise, during a prolonged illness. Enforced inactivity and frequent solitude opened the door to a time of reflection and meditation. While sick and housebound, I experienced the love and concern not only from my family, but my church family, my neighborhood, my town. Even alone, I felt the connection to the circles of community. And what does this have to do with that which cannot be named? And why do I use that euphemism? Not out of fear of Voldemort, but because of all the baggage that comes with the names. Let's try to name it. What do the names in this very short list bring to mind for you? God, the divine, Jehovah, higher power, Krishna, Jesus, the Great Spirit, Earth Mother, and so on. And we'd be here for days if we named them all. In 1953, Arthur Clarke wrote a short science fiction story, The 9 Billion Names of God. The premise was that a group of Tibetan monks were naming the names, and when they had named them all, the world would end. Two Western scientists come with a computer to help speed up the process. Remember, this is 1953, very early days when the computer was a huge piece of gear. In order to have a big project on which to test this new technology, they packed all the parts up the mountain to the monastery in a pony train. They were skeptical of the monks' project. So they made sure that the horses were ready to take them down the mountain before their hosts could finish running this incredible program. As they rode down in the dark, they turned around to look up. And they saw the stars blinking out one by one. Was this a cautionary tale about accepting science over mystery? Certainly for the monks, all names called on the same God. There is no question that for UUs, naming, never mind defining, that which cannot be named, can be a source of friction. In an inclusive community, ranging from folks who identify as atheists or secular humanists, to those who follow earth-centered rites or identify as UU, sorry. From those who follow earth-centered rites or identify as UU Christians or UU Buddhists, how can there be a common language? All we can do is individually come to an understanding of that mystery and collectively respect each other's journey. Here is a summary of some of the stopping places on my own journey to the credo I now hold. In my childhood, I was raised in an Italian-American community, family, with a few Polish relatives, all Catholic with a very few exceptions. And the image of God was the Michelangelo God reaching out his finger to Adam on the Sistine Chapel ceiling. Powerful, paternalistic Father God. Also the Italian-American polychrome statues in church. I particularly like the one where the Virgin Mary had her foot on the snake head. If you don't have that tradition, the Virgin Mary is supposed to have crushed the devil, and the devil came to her as a snake, which is an echo of Eve in the Garden of Eden being faced with the snake, and Eve in Latin is E-V-A, Eva. And how does Gabriel address Mary at the Annunciation? Ave, A-V-E. There was a whole medieval carol that started off, Nova, Nova, Ave Fitex Eva. Good news, good news. Hail was made out of Eve. So I love that Mary with her foot on the snake head. And in our bedroom, there were some pictures on the wall. Bambi and Thumper and Flower, and I believe they glowed in the dark. And there was also a picture of Jesus sitting down surrounded by lambs. I think he was very blonde, kind of Nordic Jesus. That was childhood. God was a very physical male thing. And when I was very little, kind of confused with Thumper. When I was a teenager, I discovered the pocketbooks. Many of us are old enough to remember the 39-49 cent pocketbook that would fit in your pocket. And the bookstore in Springfield had a section on of philosophy, and I arbitrarily picked up Spinoza. I think I was 14, 15, a high school freshman. He was a radical thinker rejected by his own Jewish community for his blasphemous thoughts about God. Like so many other religious reformers, philosophers, and misfits, he found a home in the Netherlands. He famously equated God and nature as one, and in his ethics he says, "The infinite being is God or nature." This appealed to me as it fit into my childhood catechism of God being omnipresent or everywhere. I'm not sure that my catechism teacher meant that God was in the dandelions, but I kind of liked that. Then in college, I continued my study of the Enlightenment, including Newton and the mechanics, and I came to think of God as the cosmic watchmaker who wound all this up, sat back, and let nature take its course. By my late 20s, I had a blend of really mutually exclusive ideas. I would say that I believed in God, but not a consistent concept. God is a distant creator, not involved with day-to-day human behavior. That was how I could believe in God, but accept evil in the world. So remember, my generation in U.S. history, we were lucky to get to World War I in our high school course. We never got to World War II. We never got to the Holocaust. I had discovered that in high school by myself, having a coat shortened by the seamstress in a store in Springfield, Mass, and looking down, she had a wrist pincushion, and on her forearm, she also had a number. And I had read enough by that time to know what that meant. So my God had to be a distant God who didn't really get involved day to day, because otherwise, how could things like that happen? But I also wanted to believe that God is love. Back to Jesus and those lambs. In the 1970s, I had a very powerful experience in graduate school in a comparative literature class that was exploring the origin of self-consciousness. The self, separate from class, religion, or any other external identifier. I felt terrified by the potential of solipsis, in which the individual defined self as the only reality and in isolation. I felt that way could lead to madness. I spent a terrifying night wide awake in the dining room of the old house we lived in. I could not stop staring at the beige and tan pebble-patterned linoleum floor, thinking that my life had no more order and meaning than the random pebbles. I began to doubt that there was any reality outside my increasingly panicking mind. No husband sleeping upstairs, no orange and white cat sleeping on the table next to me. No darkened small town a few steps outside the front door. Climbing the stairs to my sleeping husband brought me back to a physical reality that I recognized, and dawn brought the proverbial new day. Still, the memory of that panic never disappeared. But this was also a time in my life when I was not only teaching 20th century American history and learning about the socialists, the progressives, learning about Dorothy Day. I was learning more and more about Catholic radicals who focused on service to the poor and less on dogma and doctrine. The fear of solipsistic isolation was met by the hope that by serving others, that isolation would be avoided. Indeed, for me, God, however it should be named, did become love. Not the personification of a loving parent, but the force of love in action itself. Service is indeed my prayer. Perhaps we cannot agree on a name for that which cannot be named, but it can be experienced in positive human connection. Matthew said that God is present when we call on him together. The act of reaching out and accepting the gift of the extended hand is the manifestation of the divine spirit among us. When you go home and they open the door to you, no matter how long it's been, no matter what you may have done, they open the door. That is the manifestation of the divine spirit of love among us. And now, if Quinn will come extinguish the chalice, and we will share the words in the order of service. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. And I managed to skip the last hymn, which we all of our communities have their own sequence, and I lapsed. So I'm very sorry, Donna. And if we could sing Gather the Spirit, number 347. And now, closing words. I wrote these long before COVID-19 became part of our vocabulary. It is a prayer for joined hands. I'm not going to change the words of the prayer, but depending on your comfort level, rather than join hands with the person next to you, you could put your hand on their shoulder, or you could just reach out. But please don't reach up to that Sistine Chapel. please reach out to each other, even if you don't join your hands. May the shared warmth of our hands represent the warmth of the love that we share. May this contact with each other remind us of the gift of the hand reached out and also of the blessing when we accept that hand. Offering to each other comes more easily to most of us than accepting. And that to remember, without the touch, without two ways, there is no warmth. Community requires touch. May it be so.